Welcome to the One Shot Test Kitchen. Today's episode, Dungeons & Dragons OGL. Hello everyone and welcome to the One Shot Test Kitchen where we try and review tabletop RPGs. I'm Mike Kelly and I'm joined as always by Samara.
Hello!
Should have written a different intro because that's not actually what we're doing today. We're actually going to be talking about some news that has been breaking lately around the Dungeons & Dragons OGL or open game license that's been going on recently. And I figured I could just blather on about it, but I figured I'd bring in an expert. So I'd like you all to meet Chris. Chris, say hi.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Chris. Are you, sure. You're a gamer, I assume.
I am ever since the Apple IIe and watching my brother play Zork. I thank you for calling me an expert. That's a very kind compliment. I wouldn't use that term, but I might know a few things about contracts. Basically I'm a lawyer who's worked in the game industry for over a decade. First running my own shop, repping indie game developers, small publishers, that sort of thing. And I recently just finished a stint as an in-house counsel for a mobile video game publisher. So I've sort of seen things from the inside, not tabletop publishing, but there's many similar contract and IP issues come up.
Yeah, your specialty is IP, your intellectual property, correct?
Yeah, I would say it's more a focus on game industry and entertainment. IP is usually a big part of that, but a lot of it is sort of contract law, terms of service, that like IP a lot of times comes up in the context of contracts, which the OGL is, right? And so it's not like a copyright lawsuit in court about a song. It's a written contract that, you know, may or may not be enforceable, and you know that's where it all comes up. Like the wording becomes very important rather than like case law.
Totally. So there's a lot of like thorny legal issues that have been coming up, and there's been a lot of like capital D discourse happening on the internet about a lot of this stuff. So I figured we'd just have kind of a conversation about the OGL, what it is, what it means for Wizards of the Coast, what it means for Dungeons and Dragons, and all that kind of thing. I wanted to very briefly give an introduction about like what has been going on with the OGL. So OGL is the Open Game License. It is something that was originally released alongside Dungeons & Dragons 3rd Edition. And it was I believe it's a 12 bullet point document, or it may have been like revised to a 12 bullet point document at some point. It's tough to get the original, but it has been lightly edited over the years. And it was designed to basically open up Dungeons & Dragons, the core game system, the D20 system from Dungeons & Dragons as a brand, and allow for the publishing of third-party content that would supplement Dungeons & Dragons or the core game. Their whole idea was basically like, you know, Dungeons & Dragons doesn't need to be the best role-playing system, but it's the biggest one. So if we have enough people playing it, you know, no matter how many people join the hobby, they will eventually have to learn something about Dungeons and Dragons in order to be in this community. Later in 4th edition, they rescinded the OGL and replaced it with an SRD, if I'm not mistaken, system rules document or something like that.
The SRD is, I think, part of the original OGL. The SRD is all the stuff. So monsters, classes, attached to it. I think there was a different term for whatever they did in 4th edition.
It is. GSL, Game System License. Sorry, there's a lot of acronyms. I'm going to trip over my own ass on this shit. So with the release of 4th edition, it was 2008. They rescinded it. Huge pullback from third-party developers because it was a lot more restrictive. 4th edition, the core system was not well received for a bunch of reasons aside from that. So 4 years later came 5th edition, which is the edition that's live today. And this is that brought back a slightly updated version of the OGL. Now, the current kerfuffle involves the new version of Dungeons & Dragons, which is called 1D&D. 1D&D is currently in playtesting.
I just want to, before we go too far on all these steps, like just a sort of dumb thing, which is that sort of, I think to point out what is like important about having the OGL and this content that's being created is that, you know, it created this whole platform for people to play the game in different ways, personalize it for themselves, and then send that out to other people, right? Correct? Like I could create a module based on your system, or I could create content using your rules and send it out. And I wasn't going to get hit with a lawsuit for doing such, because the way that this document was set up was that, like, I was allowed to create content that was inspired by and using this game system, and it was safe to do so. Correct?
Yes. I think, well, I can't speak to the exact intent, and I think some of that is part of the argument because they're bringing in people who were there in the room. Though as a lawyer, I would say it kind of doesn't matter what they intended in their head or in their heart at the time. What matters is what's in the document and how a court might interpret it. From a legal perspective, it matters a whole lot from a feeling of right and wrong and who's being the bad guy, right? And so I you'll hear me do this a lot, but I want to separate out sort of the legal world of how the law might work if it came to a lawsuit, and then the narrative, like the D&D story of the good guys and the bad guys and you know, who's fighting.
Right. And I just think it's important to note that really since third edition, we've had years of people operating under this sensibility of creating content. And I think, you know, the really big crazy one that maybe like people who are not so deeply entrenched in the game world is like there's a whole game Pathfinder that then like spun off because of this and created its whole own fandom and, you know, everything else that's happening from there. So I think there's a lot why it feels like such a big deal when we're talking about changing this or the way that people are engaging with this is that there really has been a kind of standard for years that has been in place for the way that people engage with this game.
And so this OGL has been live since 2012, more or less, or in effect, or I don't know the exact term, but you're right in that, like, this was speaking to its intent. Like, yeah, it's not terribly important, but this actually kind of was an anti-competitive move, which is kind of strange to think about it. This is an old article that interviewed the man who was in charge of Wizards of the Coast at the time. He referred to this as the SCAF effect, named after some internal staffer who had come up with this idea, which is all marketing and sales activity in a hobby gaming genre eventually contributes to the overall success of the market share leader in that genre. So that was actually like, it was not all rainbows and unicorns. Like this was actually, to a certain extent, had a business theory behind it.
I mean, surprise, surprise, Wizards of the Coast is in fact a for-profit corporation.
Yes.
Who knew?
I don't know. Their products, though. No, no. Look at their other... Oh, wait, no.
But yeah, so but that actually kind of segues us into what's been going on here. So since the adoption of the OGL, like there's been really a golden age of D&D, like for about a decade now, like more or less. I mean... there's definitely been the rise of real play podcasts. You know, if you must listen to another podcast, there are other podcasts out there that play D&D, such as the most famous is Critical Role, but there's stuff like The Adventure Zone, Dimension 20, all that kind of stuff. And these kind of like fit under the aegis of like they're playing with the Dungeons and Dragons system on their own podcast creating systems. You know, they've gone to other systems here and there, but like that's kind of where they made their bones. Now, the current kerfluffle comes with 1D&D, which is the new system that's currently in playtesting that's due out in 2024. There was rumors that the OGL was going to be like replaced with something else. Those were largely rumors until about beginning of this month, January of 23. In an article that was posted on IO9, the journalist Linda Codega got hold of an early version of the OGL. And this basically had some pretty radical changes here. A couple things I'm just going to list off, and we're going to talk about them more in depth as we go through this. First off, there was a royalty system for people who used the D&D system. It would not be effective for people below a certain amount of sales, but anything over that, there would be a certain royalty paid. There was kind of a walk back of the third party content that was created under the new OGL. It says here that they would have and I'm quoting here from the article, a non-exclusive, perpetual, irrevocable, worldwide, sub-licensable, royalty-free license to use that content for any purpose.
I'm just very excited to have someone break that legalese down into actual like common parlance.
I mean, the gist of it is basically like, you know, Wizards can monetize your third-party content without paying you anything.
Well,
okay, that's that was I was about to ask, is that correct?
I'm going to plant a flag there. Do you want to get into that now, or do you want to do the whole overview and we can...
Let me just, like, the last part that people have been talking about is that there is also a new registration system for content. Like, you would have to, like, register your product with Wizards to say that this is OGL compliant. But yeah, okay, but let's get into that. So I think the meat of it is, like, yes, that the fact that, like, this third-party content may be used by Wizards without paying royalties. Chris, what is your legal take on that, I guess? Or
yeah, so this kind of clause is called a license back. It is actually pretty common in the entertainment industry, and it serves a pretty non-nefarious purpose, but you can understand how all the context around this made people interpret it in the worst way possible. When you own the copyright in something, mm-hmm. you have the right to do a lot of things, you know, all the stuff like distributing it, making copies, broadcasting it, all that stuff. But there's a very important right that comes with copyright ownership, which is the main thing that we're talking about here. Trademarks there too, like the name D&D and the logo. But mostly we're talking about like the actual written content and pictures in the Dungeon Master's Guide and the Player's Handbook and all that, right? Mm-hmm. And Wizards of the Coast definitely owns that. And they actually own what's in the SRD, which is the like stripped down version of the Player's Handbook and Monster Manual that they distribute with the OGL.
So when we say SRD, we're saying like the classes, the rules on how a D20 system works for your strength stats and some of the core monsters and stuff like that.
Exactly. So basically the original OGL is like 1.5 pages of legal document, mm-hmm. followed by 300 pages of like a Monster Manual / Player's Handbook Lite mm-hmm. combined. So
got
it's
it.
Like you've got all the basic classes, but there's only one subclass for each of them. Right?
Got it.
And in the monster section, you've got like stats for Panther and Goblin, but you don't have certain classic monsters that they consider part of their product identity. So like Beholders or Displacer Beasts, you know, certain things that are really classic and that they say this is like D&D specific versus some fantasy role-playing game that uses our rules.
Got it.
And so they, and that was, by the way, that was the case even in the original OGL, the OG OGL. And so, sorry.
No,
here for it.
The reason I mentioned that is that one of the other things you get when you own copyright is the right to authorize or create derivative works. And that means stuff that's based on copyrighted work. So you should think sequels, add-ons. So in a game, it could be a sequel or downloadable content. It could be, you know, mini episodes. It could be, you know, a spin-off comic for if you have the X-Men, you do a spin-off comic with Wolverine. That's a derivative work of like, you know, of the X-Men mm-hmm. copyright. And so what they did with the OGL is they said, look, they're kind of getting out ahead of people making their own fan content and said, you know what? We're going to just say right up, we're going to give you a legal framework where you have some kind of predictability where we say you can actually, we're going to give you a license, which is basically somebody who owns copyright officially legally authorizing you to use one of the rights. Like, so a license to, and you can split off, you don't have to give someone a full license to everything you can do with your copyright. You could say you have a license to distribute physical copies of this book in Brazil. If that's what your license says, that's all they can do. Mm. And if they distribute physical copies of your book in Portugal, then they've breached it and they're in trouble, right? Because that's copyright infringement. Mm-hmm. So what they did was basically say, you guys have, and this is under the original OGL, you have a worldwide right to reproduce and make derivative work. So like new modules, new adventures that might use goblins or the mm-hmm. stat block for cultist or whatever is in there, or, you know, classes like, you know, species like elf or classes like wizard, you can use all that stuff. You don't have to rewrite it or write your own kind of version of it that doesn't use the same words. You can just straight up reference it. That saves a lot of time. It made things a lot easier. And as long as you stick to just the stuff that we've told you is okay in this SRD, you basically have a legally sound license that, you know, we can't really come after you.
So not when you say they can make it, like we're not talking necessarily just about freely released fan works. Like there was an implicit,
commercial.
You can sell this. You can sell these things.
It was commercial. Yeah. And I think that was the intent, right? And as I talked to a friend of mine recently, you know, who's been involved in tabletop role-playing games even longer than me, right? This is the guy who ran my D&D campaigns at summer camp, literally, as a counselor, because he's, you know, maybe like 7 years older than me. And he was telling me, yeah, around, you know, the 90s, D&D was kind of a joke. It was seen as a dying brand. White Wolf and other systems like Vampire the Masquerade, that kind of stuff was ascendant. And then they put this out and suddenly the shelves of game stores had a whole bunch of third-party D&D content. And that's, I guess, that theory, the effect they were talking about, where it's sort of like, as long as games in general are popular, if there's more stuff for yours, it's gonna help you be the, you know, as the industry leader. So I think, yeah, the commercial part is, I think, very important because there is a lot of confusion as to what activities that we now know about. You know, it's not 2000 now. It's 2022. Podcasting is a thing. Crowdfunding is a thing. Actual play videos and podcasts are a thing. Digital distribution is a thing. You know, blockchain is a thing. People being able to make video games with a team of one or three people is a thing. All of which were not really in anyone's mind in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff is important because one of the things they've done in the leaked draft is to narrow the scope of what is being licensed.
Mm-hmm.
It used to say you can use all this D&D stuff that's in the SRD document for any purpose. And they kind of assumed, I think, at the time that that would mean people were printing, you know, third-party modules. But actually now, that could allow you, as it's written in the very short original OGL, to make a video game or a movie or a comic or, you know, any number of other things. And I think Wizards has stated that they actually didn't intend that, or at least that's how they feel now. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things they've done is to narrow the scope of the new license, say this is just for tabletop role-playing games in printed or static digital, e.g. PDFs, medium. So it doesn't, you can't rely on this license if you're making it like an app, you know, a third-party app that's doing something or a lot of these things.
One thing I want to bring up is like you are kind of talking about something. So just to jump ahead a little bit here, D&D or Wizards of the Coast did release a statement called an update on the open game license. They actually are specifically making the same point that you are making here. It says here, the next OGL will contain the provisions that would allow us to protect and cultivate the inclusive environment we're trying to build and specify that it covers only content for TTRPGs. That means that other expressions such as educational and charitable campaigns, live streams, cosplay, VTT, virtual tabletop uses, will remain unaffected by any OGL update. So it seems that they are cognizant of that. Like, you know, that they are trying to update this for the era we live in. They just may have been, or the leaked draft may have been too broad a brush.
So I can go back. I think we were talking originally. We've kind of gone far afield from the license back part, but I'll just put parentheses around this. Maybe we put a pin in this particular thing, because the talking about whether it covers everything or just tabletop RPGs, there's some important stuff to discuss there, because the OGL is not the only source of clarity and rights that you could get to make what I would just call D&D stuff. The OGL is one thing you can rely on, but there are two other things that I know of. There's the Wizards of the Coast fan content policy, which is on their website, which again, this is somewhere where I can't speak with total authority, and I don't know what I have not had time to review in its entirety. But my understanding from sort of glancing over it is that is more appropriately what you're relying on when you're doing an actual play podcast, generally. Or if you're someone who does character art for people for commissions, right? Or any of that stuff. They've got this whole policy that says what is and isn't okay for that. Mostly that is non-commercial. But there may be some exceptions for sort of what's okay. And then there's a thing called the DMs Guild, which is a website that they have, which is effectively WotC's, Wizards of the Coast. I assume your listeners probably use the term WotC. So
we're hip, yeah.
I'm trying not to use like too much target, but
this is a gaming podcast, dude.
Yeah, I know.
Listen,
I know.
You can say whatever you want. Just say what it is the first time you use it, and then use the acronym.
That's fair. Well, that's lawyers love doing that, definitions in the parentheses. But they also have an official marketplace. And that marketplace is a place where you can make and sell for money D&D content. For instance, for my home game that I run, they were fighting some potion monsters that like absorb potions. And I thought, there aren't enough cool potions in the player's handbook. And I went and paid like $3 and I bought some random person had written up 50 creative extra potions that you could use for D&D. And it was sold on the DM's Guild. Mm-hmm. I went on its official marketplace. That website has its own terms of service, which you agree to when you sell there, right? Which is, again, you know, it's the thing you click through and completely ignore and say, yeah, I totally read this, but you didn't. That matters because that's effectively the contract you're agreeing to when you, as a random person, you know, could be a person just on their own who had a couple cool ideas and wants to sell a PDF for $2 a pop. Mm-hmm. That's another way that you can make and sell, but that has its own set of terms. So the OGL is not the only thing that allows mm-hmm. people to do cool D&D stuff. And I think sometimes there's this implication that if the OGL changes, everything collapses and there's nothing else, there's no other way that someone could possibly make D&D stuff. And I wanted to kind of clarify that.
That's true. But I mean, there are plenty of people who sell not through the DM Guild or something like that. They could sell through something, through like another third-party marketplace or something like that, which presumably the OGL would be instrumental in like saying whether they can do that or not.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm not minimizing the fact that the OGL is massively important, especially mm-hmm. to a lot of the much bigger third-party publishers, like your Kobold Presses, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Pathfinder, because they are of a size where they have employees, right? They may have 20 employees that they are paying. So they're running a large scale business that needs to plan and needs to be able to know that suddenly they won't be disallowed from selling all of their products.
So can we talk about that for a second? Yeah, because I feel like a lot of this is getting at certain things like Pathfinder that have become their own kind of driving economic forces. And so is something that is so clearly based off of third edition and then has since become its own thing. Is something like Pathfinder at risk if they change this kind of language, or if it's still based on third edition and Pathfinder is so far along in its development? Like, is that type of thing so established that it's safe? Like, how does that kind of play into this?
That's a great question, and one that I'm sure that the people at Paizo have been discussing vigorously with their lawyers.
Mm. Yeah.
The way that I understand Pathfinder to work, I've played Pathfinder once, and I did not, I kind of missed all of D&D from like second edition in the 90s through when they started fifth edition.
Mm-hmm.
Pathfinder, the core of Pathfinder, like the species, the classes, uses, and some of the monsters use the SRD, and they do rely on that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It would be, but there's a whole lot of other content, for instance, all the fiction of the world is their own creation.
Right?
It's not set in the Forgotten Realms. That's all their own. And having created that independently, that's going to be its own copyright,
mm-hmm.
except to the extent that it's something that's really spun off from D&D. What's interesting, though, and this is where you get interesting to lawyers, that may be a headache mm-hmm. to other people, is it is not crystal clear that everything that Wizards of the Coast originally put in the OGL, or rather in the SRD, you know, the 300 mm-hmm. pages attached to it, that all of that stuff is really protectable by copyright.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to really go to court and have a fight and it goes to the appellate court or the Supreme Court, well, who knows, because they're terrible at IP and don't understand it, but things like rule systems are not traditionally protectable. It can get murky because there's so much content that's ranges from kind of generic and, you know, orcs, right? That's spun off from Tolkien, right? Mm-hmm. Goblins are, a lot of this stuff is from general mythology, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then filtered through really, really bad art in like the late 70s.
Right.
If you look at the original Monster Manual, it's hilariously bad.
It's beautiful in its own way. But
yes.
It is, yes. It's its own kind of ugly beauty. I mention that because the question becomes like, and this may be a good time to mention what Paizo has sort of announced while it's sort of striking while the iron is hot, because it's kind of connected to this. So Paizo announced that they're kind of leading a charge, and they've got sort of other third-party publishers on board. They've announced boldly that they're going to create their own kind of open game system, which has some acronym that spells ORC.
Yeah,
which
is- So it is the Open RPG Creative License, ORC license. yeah, and like charging forth, like I they are definitely like seizing the moment here. Like even the image on their site where they announced this is like literally the image of someone charging forward. Like they are definitely trying to run the bridge here.
And how much does this ORC license actually really borrow from what games like Blades in the Dark, Forged in the Dark did? They also said, we have this game system, make the modules you want. All you have to do is say that it is like sort of has that tag on it.
Well, first things first, there is no ORC license yet. This is an announcement that they're developing it. So
fair enough.
We don't know the specifics of this yet.
And fun little fact, one of the founding partners at the law firm they are using to develop this new license was one of the lawyers in 2000 who helped draft the OGL.
Oh, wow.
Which I'm sure they feel really good about, nabbing. So I mentioned sort of the stuff about what is and isn't protectable, because the reason Paizo, I think, feels that it can do this is that it probably believes that it can kind of strip out from Pathfinder the things that are covered by the OGL and kind of remove all the D&D stuff to the point where they would feel safe should it come to a lawsuit saying, look, We deliberately stripped out any copyrighted material that you own. We're not releasing this under the OGL, and we've changed fighter to warrior, or we've changed, you know, whatever. Or we're going to say, you know what, wizard is just such a generic term that it's not, you know, it's
you can't own wizards.
Yeah, well, copyright. A lot of this stuff with legal things is about risk, right? Because it turns out that it's really expensive to go to court. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the maneuvering has to do with people getting a legal opinion and figuring out, okay, what's the percent chance based on, you know, good legal advice that we really are actually infringing copyright, that we'd lose this case if it was correctly decided.
Mm.
But then what's the chance that the other side is going to want to spend the resources to call us on it? And if they do call us on it and we go to court, if it's kind of murky, or is it going to become so expensive that they don't want to do it? And you do all these calculations to figure out what you think the other side's going to do, right? It's not like you can just snap your fingers and a robot judge comes in and goes, this side wins, and you know, you move on and it's the next day. If it were that easy, this would all get settled, right? But it's millions of dollars and a lot of time, and there's a PR angle to it, and all of this stuff gets included. And so they, having been inside a company, I've had to advise on stuff like this, where you have a scenario where you think, oh, well, this, you know, these people breached this contract, or they did this, they released cheats and hacks for our game. Mm-hmm. And it's not an automatic, okay, so we crush them. It's, how much effort and time is it going to take to do this? How much money is it going to take to do this? Will there be a press blowback? Will there be a community blowback? We talk to our community managers, and like they really do think about all this stuff when they're going through all of this, because it's a business and it's resources. Like if someone's spending the next 6 months, a lawyer that you're paying a salary to is spending the next 6 months just handling this dumpster fire or this lawsuit, and you're hiring outside firms, that's a big thing. So I think what has happened is that people's faith that Wizards is committed to kind of maintaining this ecosystem has been shaken. That's the public level stuff. I think when it comes to the third party people, obviously Wizards is kind of pissed that Paizo exists. And I mean, and to be fair, this is me putting on my like personal hat, not just a lawyer hat, but like I don't necessarily see Paizo as these noble good guys, right? They're a competitor. They're just a competitor, and their entire product was able to be launched and exist because they got licensed stuff for free from their main competitor.
So let me split that very quickly. So because I do want to talk about Paizo more in depth, but like to your point, like the loss of public confidence in Wizards and Dungeons and Dragons, all that kind of stuff is probably the bigger effect here, I think. Like, you know, D&D has that like kind of a groundswell of like a lot of like small producers, people making, you know, their own little real play podcasts or modules or something like that, or even like things on itch, things on other third party things that could be sold. What should those people be thinking now from this like point of view? Because there's been reporting that like the mood among some of these communities is like panicked, like, oh God, even if it's not a full-time job for them, it is a revenue stream. It is a way to build their communities and their followings. Like, should they be concerned about these changes? You know, Wizards has said they may be rolling back some of this stuff, but like, we still don't have the final document. So,
I am trying to say this in a way that it is sensitive to the fact that this, for a lot of people, can be a livelihood or a way that, you know, a side hustle that makes their financial life make sense, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to be sensitive to that. At a very top level, though, this is some not official legal advice, but let's just say life learnings from a lawyer who works in entertainment. When your business, be it a side hustle or a full-blown company like Paizo, is based on somebody else's intellectual property, mm-hmm. it is always at risk. Mm-hmm. It is always on shaky ground. There is no license and no promise and no really cool person running the company that can ever convince me that you're on solid ground. And the reason is the way the law works. They fundamentally own the copyright and the rights. And copyright is a very powerful right. Disney, through a lot of lobbying, has made sure that it basically lasts forever, longer than any of us will be alive. And I think that's something that people should consider. You should go in with open eyes that if you are making, and this actually applies in the video game industry a lot too, right? People build a whole brand and they make all this content based on, you know, Destiny or Call of Duty, and they're streaming. At the end of the day, you are sort of basically working for a company without really having any, without them having any obligation to you. Mm-hmm. At any moment, they can change their minds. And so that, I think that's important to keep in mind. To zoom in a little more to the detail level, in this case, if you are someone who's just, I don't know, you're doing fan art or you're selling like dice or little models that you know, custom make on Etsy, or you're even just putting out, if you're putting out free stuff, I don't think this changes a lot, to be totally honest. If you're making money, I mean, we can go into a bit of the detail of what was in the leaked OGL. And we should also say that Wizards has since on Friday put out a statement, which I'm sure you'll link in the in the show notes, but where they basically understood that this blowback had happened and that they've said, okay, we're not actually going to release the official final version to the public. We had been slated. It got delayed once. It got delayed a second time. And then they basically said, you know what? We need a little more time to work on this. We hear you. Yeah. We can't achieve all the goals we set out. Here's what we're going to take out. And they took out the royalty stuff. But I will say what it would have done is impose royalties, but only on $750,000 in gross revenue per year and above.
So that's slightly different. Let me read what it says here. So the royalty structure was for anyone making over 50,000. And then there was another tier above 750,000. Let me get the exact language here.
My understanding was that reporting kicked in at $50,000, meaning that if you made at least $50,000, which means it's kind of a full-time thing, right? Or you got really, really lucky with a side thing, that they want you to actually report your revenue to them. And that's, again, that's not a nefarious anything. That is very industry standard, or it may be nefarious, but it is certainly industry standard to do that if, if you're licensing things and you want to know who's
making. Also take this, like, I think it's important to also take some of these examples out of, like, it's easy. Wizards has their own reputation of what they've done with other games and what they do as a company. But you take this like outside of that realm and you say, like, just think if you created something and it got really popular and it spun off into all these things, being able to have people report back so that you can say my company's value or this IP's value is not just what I'm reporting on my annual report, but also an additional $50,000 from what this person is doing based on my ideas. They're not saying, you know, at that level, they're not saying you're giving me anything, but numbers that I can say is the value of my IP, which then they'll go sell to other people or they can go public as a company or anything based on that valuation. But I think it's to give the original rights holder access to the numbers on what you're making based on their IP so that they can better value their company, I don't think it's so terrible. It's just weird because it's coming from Wizards and we feel like Wizards is kind of shady about a lot of like certain things and other IP.
I want to clarify very quickly because I just looked at this. So it's weird. I misread it, and I think we're both right here. There are three tiers. The initiate tier, which is under 50 grand. The intermediate tier, which is 50 to 750 grand. And then expert tier, which is above that. Apparently, the royalty only kicks in at the expert tier, the 750. Yep. So I'm not sure what the other tiers mean, though. But that's a whole other question.
I mean, they're modeled after the tiers they have in D&D Beyond, to be kind of cute. They are there so that they can define what your rights and obligations are based on how much money you're making. They're saying basically, hey, you don't have to hear from us or do anything other than letting us know that you're making a thing if you're not making at least $50,000. If you're making at least $50,000, we'd like you once a year or maybe once a quarter to tell us how much money you're making from this free license we gave you. And then it's also important to note that what they proposed for the $750,000 or more, which is meaningful to companies like, to people who run a massively successful Kickstarter or to companies like, Paizo or Cobalt Press or whatever, they definitely make that much revenue. Mm-hmm. It's progressive, which is a way of saying that the $750,000 and first dollar is where you start. So the first $750,000 would not be, and again, I would say that putting on my what's normal in licensing IP and in the entertainment industry, having done a bunch of licenses, when I was at the mobile game company, we did a lot of licensed games like SpongeBob SquarePants, Star Trek, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely normal in the industry. If you want to make a product, in my case, video games, based on somebody else's IP, like creative, a show or a whatever, it's absolutely normal to be paying a royalty. Mm-hmm. Usually you're paying the royalty on the very first dollar. And a lot of times you're paying what's called guaranteed minimums, which are you're guaranteeing that you're going to sell enough, and if you don't sell enough to pay them a royalty, you still end up owing them that. So, and that's a slightly different universe, right? But it is normal, and 25% is within the normal range. I've seen stuff from like 18 to 25%. So that being said, I think we should really keep an eye on the fact that a lot of the problem comes from the fact this OGL has been around in one form or another for 20 years. People are used to it. When you change a thing that people have gotten used to, even if that original thing was very generous, it always feels like you're losing something. Mm-hmm. And the original OGL, from my legal perspective, is fucking insane. It is wild. It's a one and a half page, super light, bare bones, vague in some places, license, very incredibly broad license to do it for anything. Doesn't specify that it's for tabletop role-playing games. It could be for anything, which is part of what they, I think, in all fairness, have reasonably, said as an issue. Mm-hmm. It's a license to do any of that, basically forever. They don't have to do that. That, that's basically like Disney coming out and being like, hey guys, open Star Wars license. Go ahead, write comics and books and stuff, and you don't have to pay us a dime because we want the Star Wars brand to grow. That would be cool. And I want to say I have personal philosophical feelings about the way that copyright law and globalization have caused a handful of companies to own a majority of human cultural output. Mm. I think that's crazy. But that's a philosophical question. And it's like we're talking about the legal framework and economy that we work within, the really real world as it is. This is pretty wild that they ever did this in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I think what's happening is they're trying to be like, hey, can we bring this back to something that's vaguely normal and actually, frankly, still pretty generous on an industry standard basis? It may be sketchy and bad for other reasons, and I'm open to that too. But it's not crazy from a business perspective.
But again, partly because going back to who's the one who's holding it, because if this story is about me, Samara, who wrote this really cool story and had an insanely successful Kickstarter and out of nowhere had a massive fandom blow up. And I was like, yeah, guys, do whatever you want. We're all fans of this thing I created. And then a couple years into it, I realized that there's basically millions of dollars on the table that could be attributed to my original IP. And I came out and was like, well, I'm just trying to really just say that this was my original idea. I think a fandom would react a little bit differently, but because I think it's with somebody that is perceived as, again, one of the big giants in the room that's already just like has a reputation of sucking up other games and just bringing them under their thing and ballooning and ballooning and ballooning. It feels grosser, even though everything you're saying is like, this actually is a kind of industry standard. And also, like, it's not so terrible. Like, you know, there's certain icky things, but there are other parts of it that it's like, I mean, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
One thing I do just want to keep in mind, the way that you guys have been talking about this is that, like, you know, yes, it was insane that they did this and all that kind of stuff. Again, this was a business decision, like, because they had a theory about a certain way of doing this that would make them the most money.
And
like,
they were right.
And they were right. Like, yeah, it proved it out 100%.
They just didn't have a plan for how to walk it back once it got that big.
Yes. No, totally. And I think they just kind of, I think they were looking at Paizo, and actually just very readily I looked up what Paizo's yearly revenue is. There's no exact numbers, but it's easily in the tens of millions.
Mm.
Sure.
And like, if their revenue over 750,000, like maybe there's someone at Wizards who kind of looks at that and says like, oh, we could use some of that right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or someone at Hasbro who owns them.
Right.
That's true, too.
And I'm hesitant to bring that up because that sure. gets into the online, extremely online kind of discourse, which is where everyone basically wildly speculates about what people they don't know are doing in offices that they aren't in,
right.
Based on sort of a, well, frankly, like a D&D style plot about like evil liches plotting stuff. And it's like, guys, it's business. People do sketchy things, but also arguably the whole system is designed to promote sketchy.
Yeah.
Sketchy
well, sure, like sure. But I mean, like, it's also, they're also not talking about it. Is the thing. This had to be leaked. So that kind of leads to...
But can we talk about the fact that it was leaked? Like, I have a question for you as a lawyer that who has said, like, these things you take a lot... You know, when you were in-house counsel, you know, you consider these moves with all... You know, before you do anything, you look at all these sorts of things. They're very involved, considered conversations. And I think as somebody that's on the team that's developing this... And I sit there and I'm like, if somebody took my homework before it was done and then all these conclusions get to be jumped to, like, I look at it from an outsider person who doesn't have that experience would be like, I would be really bummed that this got leaked and that's how it opened up. But are you, as somebody who has more experience with this, being like, no, a leak is healthy because it helps impact the discourse, even if you're debating an uncooked idea?
Lawyer hat, I would be furious or... I guess despondent. Lawyers don't feel furious.
Lawyers don't have emotions.
Yeah, yeah. Lawyers have had all their emotions ground down to these dull colors. I would be furious because it's not just that the – and again, I'm anticipating comments and thoughts that people have hearing this part of the discussion, which is there is a perfectly plausible argument to say this was finished. No way. They were seeing if they could get away with it. And that's a plausible, a plausible hypothesis to describe the available facts. It may or may not be exactly true, but I would say that it's not just the lawyers doing the work and people seeing it before it's done. It really has to do with the business negotiations, because where this matters is not as much, at least from Wizards' perspective, it doesn't matter the person who's doing the live play podcast that doesn't make millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
It matters critical role, the people who are flagship driving the brand, third-party people, and make a lot of money. And it matters for people who are like these quasi, I assume places like Cobalt Press, I'm not sure how they see Cobalt Press, right? Cobalt Press puts out a lot of great content that helps D&D be a more fleshed product. I don't think a lot of people just buy the Cobalt Press books and haven't bought the Monster Manual and the Dungeon Master's Guide. If they do buy both, they'll realize that the Cobalt Press monster books are so much better. So much better. Oh my God, they're great. I highly recommend them. I've got about 12 printouts on my desk right over there as we speak because I ran my game last night and I'm using basically only monsters from them. But the point is that they may see them as like, yeah, we want you there, but like, you're a real serious business. You can pay grown-up royalties. That's how this should be working. Because the only reason they basically reckon the reason people buy your books is they're playing D&D and they want supplemental material.
Mm-hmm.
And if it weren't for D&D, if you just came up with your setting, I think it's Midgard for them. If you came up with your setting and just said, hey, people in, you know, all the not D&D games, feel free to use this. Here's the rules. It wouldn't be nearly as successful. And I think they'd be right if they said that. D&D is by far has the biggest mind share for sort of people playing and probably the biggest, I don't know, but probably the biggest economic share. So they probably look at them and think, it's only fair and normal for you to pay. And then there's the people like Paizo who are straight up competitors. And I am sure that one of the points of this was to take aim at them and try and really say, hey, you know, get the hell out, or, you know, pay us money. But, you know, really it may have been, we're going to make them this offer, which we know they will refuse. And we pretty much know that they're going to splinter off and go do their own thing, which fine. But then at least we forced them to, you know, extract all the D&D stuff from their game. That's how it feels as a lawyer, because it screws up those negotiations. And I know some reporting has said that there were a lot of like Critical Role and various other people, I'm sure Cobalt Press and various, I've spoken to a lawyer friend of mine who has a client who shall remain nameless, both the lawyer and the client, but who is one of those third-party publishers. And he said, essentially, yes, we have spoken to Wizards. We had discussions with them, right? Mm. So I think what they were doing was passing it around to the major economic players and saying, here's what we're doing. And there may have been, you know, a strategic error in not getting everyone on board or not making it palatable enough before you pitch it to people. Because there's a whole thing in negotiation of you don't automatically come in super strong, because that can be a bad strategy depending on who you're dealing with, right? If you're dealing with game companies where there's a lot more of a feeling of like, this is a mission, we do it because it's a passion, that's very different than like, we're closing this giant M&A deal to make a bunch of bankers money. Like, yeah, then it's all cutthroat people who unironically watch Wall Street and thought it was like, you know, the way you were supposed to act. And they're like, yep, nothing wrong with this philosophy. Right. That's a different thing than if you're dealing with indies or even seasoned people, but in the game industry, in which case you might want to come in with what is effectively pretty close to a reasonable thing that you think they'll accept. And then you tinker on the details because you're buying yourself goodwill by doing that. Right. And they may have, again, this is all speculation. I was not in the room. I don't like it when people speculate and pretend like obviously this thing I wasn't there for is what happened. But it seems plausible to me that maybe they miscalculated and some of the people got spooked and one of the... Is it known who leaked it? I would assume it was one of the third-party people who got it and said, I don't agree with this. And sometimes leaks happen, by the way, specifically to help negotiation, right?
Yeah.
In this case, maybe it was to drive a broader conversation. So as a player and a consumer, I think it's very healthy, right? I think there are, and even as a lawyer, I think, yes, this was not a perfect document. It definitely needed some changes. I don't think the whole idea of it was crazy, but I think that some of the things definitely needed tweaking. But yeah, they may have leaked it just to get leverage. That happens in the entertainment industry. My wife works in television, and there was a major leak of some news specifically to like get leverage in a contract renegotiation. And apparently that happens all the time. So
I did want to mention, like, so one thing that the open game license, the update on the open game license that was posted on D&D Beyond, that they have said is that they were intending to roll this out shortly after it got leaked. Like, that was the plan, was to release it shortly after it got leaked. But then the leak happened, and then they're like, okay, we got to go back to the drawing board here. Mm. They also mentioned that their intent was to solicit fan feedback and player feedback on a lot of this stuff to see what the reaction was. Do you think, I guess my question here is twofold. Obviously not knowing how Wizards operates, but like, is that a tactic that is sometimes used and like fan feedback is incorporated? Or do you think that like this leak may have been a trial balloon to say like, okay, put it out there, let's see what the reaction is going to be ahead of this. If it's too nuts, we have a bad feeling about this kind of thing.
I have seen some takes that say, oh, once they were called on it, they claim that they were going to solicit fan feedback. But how can that be true if they were about to release it when this leak happened? Mm. I mean, I think that misses a key point, which is to give the benefit of the doubt, which, you know, you may or may not want to give them, but they absolutely could both release the thing last week as they planned to do and continue to take fan feedback and then alter it. Mm-hmm. And I think something that's important to understand that I'm going to get into a little bit of contract law just as it's relevant to this, because I think it really changes how you think about it. Mm. The original OGL, first off, is something that they could change anytime they want it. It's right in there. It says in the original OGL, you know, we can update this. And that is pretty standard for any kind of consumer-facing open license. So if you had a contract just between my company and your company, you would not likely have this ability to just randomly change the terms, right? Like, otherwise, what's the point of doing the contract, right? So if we license SpongeBob SquarePants to make a video game, that license is going to have a term. Mm-hmm. It's going to say, this is for 5 years, and maybe there's an extension. Like, if we make this much money, then it automatically extends. But like, it's a very specific thing. But when you're doing something that's more like terms of service, where you could have tons of users, so whenever you like install software or sign up for any kind of service or website, you're agreeing to those terms of service, it almost always says in there, we may from time to time update this terms of service. And it might say something like, and we'll give you notice, right? But usually what they do is they basically just, before you launch the app or whatever, they say, hey, new terms of service. If you want to keep using this, you now have to agree. That was the status quo with the OGL. And I think it's important to understand that before people are like, this wonderful OGL that was perfect, at any moment, I mean, the whole reason they're doing this, the thing that enabled them to release the OGL 1.1 was the fact that they are entitled to do this at any time. Mm. And I'm actually going to break down some of that language. You had like all those lawyer words.
Yes.
It was a slightly different context, because there's that license back was something that spooked people, because it had to do with the creators agreeing that the creators would give a license to the new stuff they made back to Wizards for Wizards to use. But The actual OGL itself is a license from Wizards for all the people in the world to use the SRD content, right? And that license, I have it open here, the original OGL was, yeah, it's a simple paragraph. It says, in consideration for agreeing to use this license, the contributors, which is, you know, anyone who uses the original OGL, yeah, the contributors, which is Wizards, grant you a perpetual, worldwide, royalty-free, non-exclusive license with the exact terms of this license to use the open game content, which is the stuff in the SRD. Mm-hmm. Right? So like the more generic classes and species. What does that mean? People see the word perpetual, and this is one of those, a lot of times people think like legal words are it's like a magic language. And you know, if they think in game terms, where it's like, if you get exactly the right word, then you get the powers and there's nothing they can do. You know, it's it reminds me of the game of Song of Ice and Fire books, where Tyrion is like, some people who, you know, who don't understand writing either ignore it, and some people think it has magic power, and if you write it down, you have to do what you say. But so in this case, certain words are what we call terms of art, and they do have a certain power. And that power is that there's a lot of case law, a lot of lawsuits over hundreds of years where courts have been like, interpreted a certain word in a certain way. And that has a feedback loop where lawyers read that case and they're like, oh shit, okay, we need to change how we write contracts to make this clause like airtight. And that's why they standardize this language, because it becomes predictable. They're like, if we write it this way, we're pretty sure a court would think that it means this, which is good. Business likes predictability, because it means you can commit resources without everything falling apart around you. So perpetual throws people off. Perpetual license does not mean that the person giving you the license can't take it back. I can grant you a perpetual license to, you know, some book I wrote, and then the very next day I could get in a fight with you and be like, screw you, I revoke it. And that is 100% legal. That is 100% something I can do. Perpetual just means it doesn't have a built-in timer. So an example of a non-perpetual license would be the SpongeBob thing I said, where I'm like, I go to Viacom and I say, I want to make a SpongeBob comic or a SpongeBob game. And they go, sure, pay us this royalty. Here's this contract. You're going to have this license for 5 years. Mm-hmm. No matter what I do, after 5 years, by its own terms, the license burns up. You know, imagine it just like the scroll incinerates itself and you no longer have that power. The word that people are looking for like, haha, no backsies, is irrevocable. Mm-hmm. And they very specifically did not use that word, because you really don't want to use that word generally in business. You will see that kind of language irrevocable. You'll see when someone is assigning their copyright, like literally transferring it forever, like you own this now. Or when people are doing like Creative Commons where they, you know, for various reasons, they're like, you know what, screw Disney. Like I believe for philosophical reasons, like I want this in the public domain. Mm-hmm. They use that kind of language. But that's super important to understand. Because there is actually a fight going on where I read some stuff about the Paizo lawyer saying, you know, we actually think that it can't be replaced or deauthorized.
I remember reading some of that, yeah.
If that person was one of the people who drafted it, actually that doesn't really matter, in my opinion. It matters, you know, maybe he drafted a bad license, right? Like, that was vague. He's probably a much better lawyer than he was 20 years ago. I feel really bad if he listens to it. I don't know you. I'm sure you're a great lawyer. But my point is that lawyers make mistakes all the time, right? They draft things the best they can, but you're trying to predict the entire future of everything forever, which is why you see crazy stuff like throughout the universe for perpetuity, because they got tired of like TV being invented or the internet being invented. And then like every single contract that they had, you know, or like streaming gets invented. And then Capitol Records is like, well, shit, every contract we have from 1920 through, you know, 1990 doesn't account for this. So that's, it is kind of normal, but they absolutely can revoke it.
I have a question because you mentioned like again, not to get too magic word about it at all, but like the license back.
Yeah. So that's a separate thing.
That's a separate thing, but they do use that language of perpetual and irrevocable.
So the reason that they do that, I can only tell you the reason that it is generally done in business and why it is industry standard and pretty normal. I am not speaking to the intent or whether there's a secret plot to, you know, steal everyone's content, which as one of my friends I was talking to pointed out, he's like, yeah, they kind of stepped on their own foot. They put out the stuff that said, you give us this license to everything. And they gave it to a bunch of people who spent the last 20 years trying to find like unintended, you know, connections between species feats and, you know, rules things to get advantage. It's like, what did they think would happen? Everyone's going to pour over this and say, aha, you can do this loophole.
We call them rules lawyers for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. But the reason that you have a license back and that it's pretty normal is it's a protective thing. So the normal reason is not actually to offensively like grab other people's stuff and say, haha, gotcha, now we own your stuff that you made. It is kind of related to the reason that like movie studios are very careful when people send them unsolicited scripts. Mm. So there was like a famous case about, I don't know, I think it was Rocky IV or one of these movies where someone basically argued, oh, I sent this in and someone read it and Rocky IV is totally like this terrible script I sent in 5 years ago. So you stole my copyright. I'm going to sue you. That is a huge hassle. And people do bad faith lawsuits like that, or even good faith, but totally ludicrous lawsuits because they just went around until they got a lawyer who would agree with them, even though it's a bad suit. So the realistic scenario that they're probably trying to protect against here and what they've said, and it's not wrong. They may also have secret evil reasons to do it, but the normal reason is to say, hey, if we are in the middle of a 2-year development cycle on a new hardcover book, that's like a campaign module, and then some random person publishes, might be good, might be total crap because you're allowed to publish whatever the heck you want under the OGL, some campaign module that bears some similarities to this, they can then, we put out this thing that's making a bunch of money. We're wizards. We have a ton of money. They know that we're, you know, a fat target for a lawsuit because we could pay if they win, or that we might just settle to make you go away, which is usually the strategy, right? Extract a settlement. That's what patent trolls do, right? They need to say, look, we're letting you make anyone make anything with this stuff. That does not mean that we might not be working on something that's totally like the idea you have. Mm. And you cannot come up to us after the fact and say the Radiant Citadel or what was the recent, Candlekeep Mysteries? Yeah. Like, this thing that I published a year ago on my website and using the OGL totally is like some parts of one of the modules in, you know, one of the little one-shots in Candlekeep Mysteries. That's a huge headache. And that is what that kind of clause is there to protect against. And it is normal. Now, I do feel it was amiss to not think real hard about how you exactly structured and worded that. Mm. I want to be careful because I'm not inside Wizards, right? There are a lot of factors that go into it. And they may have thought about that and then said, you know what? No, this is our line in the sand. This is how grown-up contracts like this work. You're just going to have to trust us that no, there's nothing in it for us to like, ha ha ha, steal your thing and jam it into our thing. Like, we pay people full-time to write our own stuff. And in fact, you actively don't want to steal people's stuff because even if it's in the contract, you're still going to get people who are pissed and don't read the contract and aren't lawyers and feel aggrieved and will cause trouble. So you'd rather not ever have that even come up as press or as a threatened lawsuit. So it's, yeah, they may have just decided like, let's do the one that's airtight that de-risks our whole situation. So, and it's the kind of thing you have to do if you're going to let people have that level of freedom. You have to have something that serves that purpose.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it could have been drafted more narrowly so that it didn't give the impression that it was, you know, we can use it for anything forever. I don't know how I would draft. I'd have to think long and hard about exactly how you might narrow it, where it would still do what it needs to do, but not scare people. I don't know that that balance
sure.
exists.
Well, it's a little sure. bit of a cake and eat it too clause, right? Like, you can't sit here and say, you're not going to pay me, you're not going to pay anything for a license and for free create whatever you want off of this content. And if on the off chance we're developing something with our employees that like seems to be it, then you feel entitled to come and sue us to do that. Like, sort of the cost of doing business is that, like, well, if the ideas overlap, then like, that's fine. We were all in the universe that we created. And so we have the fundamental sort of first rights to kind of anything that's created on there. Now, does it feel shitty if you're the person who created that thing that just so happens to be there? Yeah, of course it feels terribly shitty. And like, I think that's the thing that sucks is that like, there's not, when you're dealing with this stuff, it's why you as a lawyer have ground down your emotions to nothing. Like, once you start getting in this, you can't feel good about really starting to define this stuff and put in boundaries. And when it feels like what we have been operating in for a few decades was some sort of like open creative utopia, on a certain level, yes. And to Mike's point, it served a business purpose, which is that whoever wrote the first OGL with the directive of, we want to get as many people playing this game as possible, and whatever avenue they do, they're going to come back here. It worked. They did a great job on that. But now also it's like, I don't know. People are having to pay for where they are now, and the payoff for that business decision and coming back, it's just not going to feel good no matter what they do, no matter kind of how nice it is, because so many people have made livelihoods, spun off businesses, have huge companies. And again, if you take it out of, listen to the part two where we put on our tinfoil hats and talk about who's evil and who's not in this whole situation. But like, if we keep the hats off for this, and again, just take it out of the context of that, like, I really do think, like, I mean, there has to be a contract that says, like, I created some things. There's now this huge community, and how do we make it right and good?
Yeah.
And it's going to be painful to get there.
Totally. I mean, that's actually a decent segue, because I think, like, we've talked a lot here about the legal aspects of things and, like, you know, what this word means and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I guess, what is the implication of this, I guess, on third-party creators, big creators, and even people who play this? Like, what should, like, and obviously none of us have a crystal ball here, but like, Chris, speaking more to your, not so much your legal experience, but your experience as a lawyer in the entertainment industry, in the game space, what do you think, like, the next steps here that Wizards needs to take, and that what should fans be looking for, players or third parties be looking for in the evolution of this saga? Because it's just going to evolve at this point.
Oh, that is a very big question. I don't, unfortunately, have an orb to ponder that will show me the future.
Yeah.
As much as I love pondering orbs, I would first say it's early days, and a lot of things, I guess, with the game community, I was going to say a lot of stuff goes in the memory hole, but it may be less so. Like, tabletop RPG fans are a special breed, a special species is the term
Thank
we're using
you.
Now. Yeah, a special species that thinks of things, surprise, surprise, in terms of battles between good and evil. It's almost like they've been playing games that use that archetype for a long time. So I think it's early days, and if I'm Wizards, this is a headache, a temporary headache, in terms of, okay, I mean, I feel really bad for the lawyers. I've met and spoken to the new GC, by the way, seems like a real nice guy and very competent. And I should also point out, please, 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 to the extent that you're someone I'm sure every one of your listeners are awesome people who don't do this, but like to the extent that you want to be mad at someone on the internet, don't yell at random employees of Wizards or like the lawyers who works at Wizards of the Coast because they don't love Magic and D&D. Like everybody at a company like that is there because they love that stuff and they want to be a part of it, and they are trying to balance that against, hey, I work for a company that makes, like, the reason we have the best artists and these cool writers is because the company makes a lot of money and they pay people a living salary.
I refuse this. General counsel is an evil double agent who came in to take down a game that we love. And he's done that by rewriting the OGL. Thank you very much.
I will say I did see a take that kind of dovetails with this. It's like, you know, the lawyers are not the big bad evil guy. The big bad evil guy of D&D has always been capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, that's why you should all listen to Dimension 20, The Unsleeping City, because it's awesome. But also because...
You don't plug other podcasts on our podcast.
No. Well.
Yes, community, come on. Yes, listen to Dimension. If they're doing a great take on taking down capitalism, I'm here for it.
Especially if you're a New York City person, it's a very New York thing. But yes, there's a whole capitalism angle there as bad guy. But so I think that Wizards is probably thinking D&D is still, it's having, you know, tabletop role playing games in general, and D&D in particular are having a big renaissance. They are probably thinking not this will just blow over, but 2-3 years from now, a lot of people are just going to play the game that they like and that they know. And frankly, I'm one of those people. I have 3 kids. I would love to be able to do what you do and play like try out a bunch of different tabletop systems. They sound super cool. I wish all this stuff was around and as good as it is when I was 24 and had nothing but time, but I wouldn't have been able to afford to buy all of them. But yeah, but the point is that like people are probably by and large, a lot of people are going to play what they like. And I'm thinking they would knuckle down and think, let's just make sure that one D&D is good. And if it's good, people are going to want to play it. And if D&D Beyond is a good product, which I personally find it to be very useful, and that's separate from whether you think the like payment structure is fair or whatever and blah, blah, blah. But like, it's pretty useful. I use it to run my game and it's a useful thing. Like whether or not people generally agree with me and like that stuff is going to determine whether this stuff is successful. Because, and again, this, you could very easily say, man, that's evil. But yeah, they got big and they created their renaissance. And maybe that was an input into the moment that we're in now, was the 20 years of people having stuff. But it wasn't only them. There was also Wizards of the Coast doing a bang up job putting out 5th edition.
Yeah.
5th edition is great. It's not perfect. Nothing is. But like, personally, I think it's a great, they centered the pendulum really well. And people like 5th edition. And yeah, it's cool that there's also the other stuff and all this community stuff. But I, frankly, other nerd hobbies have huge fandoms and have thriving like fan content stuff without an OGL. They've got fan content policies on their website and they just decide not to sue people unless they're doing shitty Nazi stuff or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
By the way, that's another purpose of the update. It gives them
they explicitly set up
on that that crap, and they're not wrong about it, having read it. They give themselves broad powers to be like, hey, is this transphobic and shitty? We can shut you down instantly. Let's be perfectly clear.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I want to push back on slightly, because like you're saying, like, yeah, if this system is good, Wizards is good at making Dungeons and Dragons. Like, I 4th edition we don't talk about, but like
they World of Warcraft, the board game.
Well, yeah, okay, there's always exceptions to the rule. But generally speaking, I think the other important part of this is just what the OGL speaks to is if there is a D&D, generally speaking, succeeds not only on the strength of its core SRD, but on the content that surrounds it. Mm-hmm. And if this new OGL, like either by letter of the law or by a chilling effect leads to a decline in that stuff, I think it's going to hurt D&D's popularity.
Yeah, it could.
Yeah, it very well could. And again, none of us have orbs. That, I think, is the issue. And I mean, do you think that's factoring into what Wizards are thinking right now as they talk about the new OGL?
Yeah, I think the chilling effect of the two things you mentioned is more the issue, right? Mm-hmm. If the creative energy goes elsewhere, if the non-employee creative energy, because there's a lot of creative energy at Wizards and they put out a ton of products, mm-hmm. right? It's settings and rules updates and all that stuff. But if the other mass of creative energy that is third-party stuff, because there's a lot of smart people who don't work for Wizards who make amazing content. I happen to think, you know, the Cobalt Press, mm-hmm. you know, monster books are better than the Monster Manual, for instance, right? If that migrates elsewhere, which it currently looks like they are, right? Cobalt Press was like, yeah, we're transitioning over, right? And I'm sure Paizo has been talking to all of them and wants to, mm-hmm. they would love to play the part of like the leader of the revolution and like we're the good guys. And of course,
they specifically name checked them in the orc system.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Of course. Right. Like that. Why wouldn't you? They're playing their hand properly. Right. That is the mm-hmm. hand they have. Their position in their hand is being, they're taking a good line of play, to put it in Magic the Gathering terms. It could hurt it, but I also think that they do care about reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another thing I want to actually bring up. As kind of a lawyer reading the document, and let's even assume that was what they were going to publish, right? Let's assume that the leak was what they were going to publish, mm-hmm. for the sake of argument. If that's what they were going to put out, reading it, it's abundantly clear to me there's some pretty hip actual gamer lawyers writing this stuff.
Yeah.
And I follow some of them on Twitter, and they seem like really cool people and good lawyers. They put things in there. First of all, they have like comment sections in their contract that say like, this is what the intent is here, which is very helpful. It might muddy the waters in terms of like interpretation if there was a lawsuit, but it's very clear that they do understand the ecosystem that exists. I would never say of this document, like, oh, this is drafted by people who don't understand D&D and the fandom. It's like, they totally understand it. They specifically carve out things around like Patreon, mm-hmm. right? They've written terms in there that address like, yeah, if you raise $1 million on Kickstarter to make a D&D module, yeah, that's $1 million. So the last 250,000, we're going to consider that revenue. But if you're someone who makes battle maps, and you give them out for free, but you've got a Patreon where people can get like extra access or like, you know, night versions of the maps, and that's how you make money, we're not going to count that because we know that's a thing people do and we're not interested in like stepping on that. So it's clear there's a lot of places in there where it's very clear that they've thought pretty hard, not only about like how does the ecosystem work, how do real D&D fans interact with this and the creators, but they've thought pretty hard about how will this be perceived? We want to be crystal clear about like why this is here instead of like, here's our terms of service. Don't worry about it. The lawyers made us write it, which is what most companies do. Honestly.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it's really
pretty extraordinary to me.
No, it sounds like it's really savvy and considerate, which you don't, like to your point, you don't often see in this. And it seems like to kind of the broader conversation of how does the ecosystem get impacted by this? And like, what do we think? Like, how does this like practically play out? It really does seem like it's the type of thing that's targeting these like bigger whales that came as a result of this like IP investment strategy that the original OGL really was. And I think that there are some people that like it as a system to create their own content and like have their homebrew stuff, and that things like the DMs Guild or other things, it made it very easy to say, oh, I made this thing for my game at home, but like maybe somebody else wants it. That level of person, I think, is not going to be impacted. D&D Beyond and like 1D&D may make it a little bit harder to do that stuff because I think sometimes the digital, like to engage with them on their digital platforms, it becomes a lot harder to add your own homebrew stuff. But I'm sure as they're rolling it out and as they've learned, I haven't engaged with the platform that much now to this day. I'm sure it's only going to get easier. But I think that low level of somebody who's like, I like D&D, but like I like to add a little bit my own spice. I don't need to make money off. I don't think that's going to go away. I think that's still going to be possible and still real. But I do think these like big whales that have sort of spun off are really who they're trying to go after. And I think they've done their best, maybe clumsily so, to draft language that says like, well, I just want to say that I have a piece of the pie and recognize that like the tons of money that Pathfinder's making, maybe a lot of people don't know that Pathfinder came from 3.5. And can we be clear that that came from this? Like, I don't know. Like, obviously it's its own thing now, but like, I think that those are going to be the biggest things that are impacted. And I think that as far as public perception goes, Paizo is taking their moment to establish themselves as something else in this industry. My own feelings as an individual, like I don't love that it is the one big game that is out there that is sucking up everything, and that by rewriting something like this, it almost is sucking it up more, or like really laying those lines in the sand. But maybe it creates an opportunity for more mid-tier things to be competitors or not quite associated with it. But I think that that's the level that you're really going to see most impacted by this.
That's a great point, actually, that it's possible. Again, we can't know what's in someone's head, right? Without a very good insight check. You can edit out all my bad jokes, by the way.
I mean, no, they're so delightful. And I'm just pleased that somebody's here making worse jokes than me, because normally mine are the ones that Mike's like, oh, God, why do I hang out with you?
It's a class feature of the dad class, right?
Like
dad jokes, right?
It's, yeah.
You get it at
it
first
was your
level.
Sense of humor with yeah. the first child, totally.
But I think you make a really good point that it might actually, if you wait long enough, you might see that it clears some space by driving away everyone. A lot of people are this creative energy is kind of like in the orbit of D&D. And if they feel, you know what, we kind of want to be our own thing now because it's too complicated, or we don't like the revenue system or whatever, or it just looks hip and cool to say we're leaving D&D, mm-hmm. right? That may actually create space for there to be more. Actually, in the long run, you may end up seeing more creativity because people have like untethered themselves from making kind of D&D stuff, and their imaginations are now completely unchained to do whatever. That's a possible outcome. And it also makes me think, did someone at Wizards, I mean, is someone there playing 3D chess, right? And saying, or at Hasbro or a mix of the two, and said, you know what? We do actually want to kind of clear people out so that we have more control over the big stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They want to clear out the mid-tier, and they want to say podcast creators, like actual play video, like mm-hmm. YouTube channels, people making stuff on DMs Guild. We love that stuff, and we want to make more tools for them and make it clear that that's allowed and it's all good. Maybe they just are like, we don't want Cobalt Presses anymore.
Yep.
And yes, you can make an argument. That feels really shitty to be like, you helped us get here, now get the fuck out. But yeah, that might be the intended thing, right? And they're doing it by way of saying, instead of it would, there'd be an even more villain narrative if they were like, we've decided that anyone who makes more than this doesn't get a license.
Right, right.
Get out, right? Like, we're cutting you off. That would look even worse, even if it, in our sort of framework that we're talking about here, that would be more honest, honestly. They might be sort of saying like, why don't you just see yourself out?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you could stay, but you have to pay us. And they know in their head, like, they're probably going to leave. And that's
right.
Might be what they wanted. Again, speculation.
Totally.
Hashtag speculation.
Totally. I mean, we've kind of reached that point of it. Totally. I understand. I guess in terms of, because I kind of want to like bring this to a little bit of a close here, but like in terms of like, based on everything we've talked about and based on what you've seen on the Sonic stuff and this whole moment that we're in right now, like with regard to D&D's future and Wizards' future, do you think that this new OGL, you know, with the fan feedback, if they do revise it in the way that they've said they're going to do, like, is this a positive thing? Or is this going to, like, are you optimistic about where the hobby's going to end up? Or is this kind of a weird step that, like, kind of portends maybe, not in and of itself, but kind of a change in a negative way?
Yeah, I mean, okay.
And I know it's pure speculation, but
I think they're going to release one D&D, and it's either, I think it makes sense for this hobby to evolve and take some of the best practices from the video game industry, which is like D&D as live service game, so to speak.
Mm.
By which I mean, look, back in the day and until fairly recently, you bought the player's handbook and there were some typos in it. And there were some sections that were really important that were famously unclear and that everyone argued about all the time. And maybe once the internet came along, they put up like, once every couple of years, some errata. And you're like, see, they did it. And, you know, but people are going to like Mike Merle's tweets to figure out what, you know, how things work. And this is enabled by the fact that they expect people to play more digitally. It's kind of nice that they can kind of continuously update it and tweak it and patch it instead of in these really lumpy ways, right? Mm. That's a product design question, right? And some people who play may like that. Some people who play may not like it. But I think that updating this OGL, it's part of kind of the modernization of how they control D&D and how they run the product. And I'm actually hopeful in that way because I like that. I think that's interesting. I think the way people play tends to be more online, right? COVID really like accelerated a trend that already existed.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing like the energy of playing in person, for sure. Getting Cheeto dust on the pages of your books and all that. But my game that I play, I've been promising myself to run D&D game for 15 years. Like, I played a ton in high school and in college, and then I just didn't for basically 14, 15 years. And I kept telling myself I'd do it. The thing that made it possible and the time why I pulled the trigger during COVID was, wow, there's all these tools, first party D&D tools and third party, like Roll20. I'm playing when I couldn't otherwise play. So I think they are leaning into that and knowing that that's a trend. And I think that's great. I'm personally worried about the thing that I don't like about a live service model is the like constantly having to pay stuff, like a yearly subscription. Mm-hmm. What was nice about D&D back in the day was you buy the books and like one person has them and you come over to their house and you hang out in the basement and you play. Mm-hmm. But guess what? You can still do that.
Yeah, I was about to say that. Right? Yeah.
Like you could still just play D&D. No one can tell you how to play D&D. It's not a video game. It's not on a server where your magic items are stored in the server and like unless you have your account. As I love to say to my players, and they're like, "Can I do this and that? Is that like a lot?" We're playing in a make-believe imagination game. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
This is make- no, we're playing true. Make-believe. So you don't have to follow the rules. So it's, yeah. So I'm optimistic because I like some of what I've seen in like the playtest materials and I always homebrew my own shit anyway. Mm-hmm. Like I just don't use any of the official campaign. It never occurred to me that I would use an official campaign setting. So like, I'm basically only interested in the like Xanathar's guides and like the rules updates where they're like, here's like a new, and the reason I like those is because I'm like, here's some new ideas that have been rigorously play tested and balanced.
Yes.
Because I don't have the, I don't have the time to be like, I invented a whole new class and it's ludicrously overpowered. Like that's the value of that stuff to me. I don't care about the more the settings and stuff. But that's me, right? Like it, there's no right way to play D&D. Yeah, it should be for everyone. Do whatever you want. D&D's not going anywhere. It's if only because
No. There is a way to win D&D. When you sit down, there is a way to win. You sit down and you play this game. You can win if you play D&D. You can win D&D.
Yeah, you win D&D by breaking the DM's spirit.
It's not so much winning as forcing others to lose. Alrighty. Okay, I guess any closing thoughts, I guess, forego that before from either of you, I guess, Chris or Samara.
You know, what I think this speaks to, interestingly, is I mentioned this before when we were talking about Paizo's orc system license thing that they're doing. Almost too cutesy, guys. Like, almost too cutesy to be taken seriously. I don't know. It was. But the, you know, we've seen this in other realms of the community. Like, Blades in the Dark recognized, I think, the potential to use their system to create interesting content and got in front of this idea of saying, you know, this business idea that by you using our system, you will ultimately come back to the core in some form or another. And so this to me feels part of that larger conversation of game designers recognizing that the community that gets created around tabletop, you know, at their core, these games are collaborative storytelling where we're encouraging people to be creative, that we're encouraging people to dig into the rules and maybe adjust them for how it works, right? There's no right way to play these games. And so when that meets and has a handshake with like capitalism at scale, you get something that is crazy like us, like digging into these licensing rules. But I think on a much smaller scale, we are seeing this happen in different pockets, especially as the internet makes it much easier to find this content. And I think culturally, there are a lot of people who play these games. I mean, we do this often on our podcast, and I think a lot of people have this mindset, which is that no matter what game you're playing, it's like, just give credit, right? Like, A, number one, just give credit where credit's due. And I think ultimately this licensing is just taking that concept to scale in one form or another. And it feels weird because of the players and because we're programmed to see a villain in this. And like, you know, there are all these people that in the past couple of years have made a living on the back of this IP and all this kind of stuff. But I think fundamentally the game's not going to change. And I think fundamentally it's tied to what is a good conversation that's happening in the community, which is just helping give credit where credit's due on whatever scale makes sense on where that is.
Yeah. I largely agree with that. I mean, like, my own view is that, like, yeah, this was kind of an inevitability. It was going to happen in some way or another. Like, gaming has become a lot more mainstreamed, and it's becoming a lot more. And, like, to your point, Samara, like, you know, credit where credit is due, like, it, like, sometimes we'll have to have monetary value associated with that. as well. D&D has like been so ubiquitous and such a resurgence in popularity, even pre-COVID. Like, you know, you look at stuff like Stranger Things, you look at like the new D&D movie coming out or anything like that. And it's like, yeah, no, this is becoming even more mainstream. And like, this was going to happen. Like, this was going to be something that we would have to be rolled out. Like, whether or not it's good or not, again, no crystal balls. We don't know. Right. But like,
they're not being Disney about it. About. Like, they could be super like Disney about
not
it.
Yet.
Not to not be fair. Yet, to, yes. To yes. That's, yes.
Like, who knows what the future may bring if they if like the next CEO
get that
or CEO
Forgotten
down the
Realms out of your mouth.
Yeah.
Well, and that if people take one thing away, that comes full circle back to the whenever you are basing a lot of creative work and income on somebody else's legal rights. On their IP, you are on shaky foundations. Mm. And it is a hard truth to swallow because in the last 10, 15 years, there is a huge cultural industry of people making a lot of money or at least making enough money when they weren't going to make any, you know, being streamers or personalities or doing all these hobby's the wrong word. I'm so old. you know, passion adjacent work. But at the end of the day, yeah, the legal system is not caught up. They have the power to just squash you if they feel like it, if they have a reason to. And yeah, that sucks, right? But please be clear-eyed about that and adjust your expectations accordingly. Oh, actually, one thing I didn't get in that we didn't mention. We talk about these like broad licenses that people have, the OGL and what people can do. That's what you, any person in the world can do without having to go talk to Wizards of the Coast.
Mm.
There are plenty of big companies that have specific private contracts with Wizards of the Coast, right? And that's, and in fact, the DMs Guild has stuff about that, right? If you do something truly awesome, Wizards of the Coast may approach you and say, we'd like to buy this from you or license it from you, right? So stuff like the Acquisitions Incorporated or the, I guess there's a book, you know, from Critical Role, that wasn't just them like pulling out the OGL and being like, I guess we publish this. They talked to Wizards of the Coast. They negotiated a specific private contract that we're not privy to. Like, and that can still happen as a pathway if you're truly serious about it. And like, that's what you want to do. That still exists and has always existed.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think the last thought that I have that hasn't been covered is it's important also when you're thinking about anything that's like legal adjacent with this kind of stuff. There is a difference between what a company or a person or, you know, a rights holder can do legally and what they choose to do.
Mm.
What they choose to do makes all the difference in the world. You said go all Disney about it, right? Like, you could have the right to squash, you know, every single fan stream or production or fan art, but a lot of companies choose not to. Why? Because it's shitty. And because it's bad business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it does suck that when push comes to shove, they could get their way if they have those rights. But also, they're doing these calculations. They're not just going to stomp on things because they can. That's stupid. That's bad business. That loses them money. That makes them have to pay their PR firm. Like, all of that stuff.
Well,
I don't want to say only the guilty needs to be afraid, because that's a very bad philosophy. But like, there is
also, but also bear in mind, like, some companies do make stupid decisions at points.
Yes. No.
Yeah.
I mean, that goes back to why this is why you're on shaky ground, because you never know when they might just be bad management.
Right.
Yeah.
But the fact there's a lot of distance between what you see in a contract and like what a company could do and what they are likely to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it sucks. And I think people are justly concerned that the distance between those two things is where they live, and that's an uncertain place to live. And if you're like, should I take this job that pays me and gives me healthcare, or should I go all in on my career at writing modules or being a streamer? That's someone's life and their livelihood. And to have to make that decision on basically, trust us, we won't flip the evil switch, right? Yeah, that is scary. And I'm very sympathetic to that.
Yeah.
But they could also just say no to everything. Yeah.
Right.
So.
Yeah, no, makes sense. All right. I think we'll leave it there then. I think this is a really good discussion, like both like of the legal ins and outs and also of like kind of broadly, like more holistically about where this whole thing sits. So yeah, thank you very much.
Also, thank you for the free legal advice. I will now be thinking of every creative endeavor and being like, is this based on somebody else's IP? I got this really good free legal advice once.
Is this the point? Yes,
about to say. I am not your lawyer. This is not legal. Yeah. Edit that out.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll edit that into the beginning. Every TikTok I see with a lawyer on it always starts with that.
I'll say these are legal learnings.
Legal learnings.
That's a nice bullshit term.
Lawyers.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Do you have anything you want to plug or like anything there where people can find you or?
I'm at NY Game Lawyer on Twitter and any other thing that might follow to the extent that Mastodon or whatever replaces it. But yeah, I try to be NY Game Lawyer wherever I am just for simplicity's sake, even though I live in New Jersey now, but whatever.
Who really wants to own that they're in Jersey? I don't blame you for keeping the New York Game Lawyer.
Yes. Continue to believe that. Yes, exactly. New Jersey's terrible. Don't come.
That's going to be it for us. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to us on your podcast service of choice. If you have any comments or questions for us, or if you have a suggestion for games that we should take on in the future, please drop us a line at ostkpodcast@gmail.com and follow us on Twitter at ostkpodcast. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
There's like a Kaiser Soze thing going on with New Jersey. They've convinced the rest of the world that they suck when the dark secret, and I'll probably get assassinated for this. New Jersey's actually like a really nice place to live. We want people to think it's all Snooki and like
opening credits all of the Sopranos.
I know you will. That's why I could speak the truth.